today on Doomed. It's really about ethics in journalistic career development. Folks, the right wing is at it again. And as you can tell from my very serious delivery of that, no, it's not about the right suddenly caring about how journalists are going to feed their family. Today on the show, we have Talia Levin, a freelance writer from Brooklyn, on to discuss this latest right-wing, really harassment campaign. I mean, I'd call it Gamergate Part Deux, but at this point, it's more like Gamergate Part 2000 and Deux. Talia, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks. I'm happy to be virtually here.
Oh, yeah, it's great to have you. Hold on one second, everybody. I'm pulling myself up, and I'm pulling a nice picture of Talia up so you could all see where this majestic voice from the heavens is coming from.
Yeah.
If you're all listening.
If you're listening, I have a face for radio.
No. But luckily for if you think that, this is mainly a podcast. So most people will be listening just to your voice and never know until now when I just said it that you're not also visible on the YouTube feed.
Okay. So good to know.
Right. So Talia, thank you for joining. If I didn't already say that, thank you for joining us. And let's get down to really what's going on here. Maybe we should start at the very beginning, actually. It's been a terrible few weeks for people in, really, digital media and journalism.
Yeah. About 20... more than 2,000 jobs lost in digital media over the course of the past couple of weeks. And, you know, very public, as journalism layoffs tend to be. And pretty rough out there right now.
Right. There was, I think, something like 1,000 jobs lost in total, maybe even more.
No, it was 2,000.
2,000, jeez. I was
more than,
off.
More than 2,000 total.
Wow, and that's across what? Like, it was across BuzzFeed.
Vice, HuffPost, Gannett Media, which is like a newspaper chain. McClatchy had some buyouts, like it's just all over.
Right. And you know,
not just digital media.
Right. That's true. And, you know, there's a lot that can be unpacked there in terms of what's going on with the industry. It's an industry that's been affected by companies like Google and Facebook, and even going back further than that, Craigslist. And you know, there's a lot of reasons for it. But that's, you know, and that's something I will definitely be talking about on the show, but that's not what today's about, because today's not really about...
Well, it's like tangentially about it.
Right, yes. It's not really what the right wing is worried about, though. They're not trying to figure out what's going on with digital media. Let's save these jobs.
Yeah, no. They're not, like, overly worried about anyone. Or concerned.
Right. And I think not overly worried is even giving them a little bit too much credit.
Yeah, for sure.
So Talia, tell me, because you experienced this yourself, So let's start here. What exactly happened to you that made you sort of look into this right-wing harassment campaign? And I should say that the right-wing harassment campaign is stunningly called Learn to Code. And if that's confusing anyone who hasn't been following this, Talia will get to that in a moment.
Yeah, so I wrote an article in the New Republic about this last week. What happened was, I mean, the long and short of it is I didn't lose a job, right? I lost an opinion column. I had an opinion column at HuffPost Opinion. And on the day sort of the big layoffs starting, I found out the whole opinion section had been cut, just like all of it. And so all of us columnists kind of lost our column. And at the time, that was kind of my main source of freelance income. So I just like tweeted something frustrated about it. Like, this is crazy. Like the whole opinion section's gone. you know, this industry sucks. And then all of a sudden I saw these like dozens of responses, you know, all saying variants on learn to code. That phrase, often accompanied by like, learn to code, you dumb bitch. I hope all journalists like die in jail. Like not, it wasn't, you know, in any way being told to learn to code is like from the start kind of a hostile piece of advice. It's not like friendly. It's kind of condescending and annoying.
Right. I mean, but especially, you know, someone's, you know, you just lost your job or in your case a gig and, you know, you don't want to hear someone giving you some sort of unsolicited career advice, even if that was the point of this.
Mm-hmm. It's not, it's like you lost a job, now leave your profession, which is worthless. Like that's the like quote unquote innocuous message to someone who just lost a gig. And, but I was just struck by the uniformity of it. And so I have kind of swum around in the like deeps of the right wing internet before. And like, I've written about it, you know, I've written about the Daily Stormer. I've written about, racist YouTube channels and, kind of the whole right wing, like oozing sphere that is that part of the internet. So I figured out, okay, it's gotta be coming from somewhere, something this coordinated and this immediate. Like I noticed that it wasn't just me. It was like everyone who said they'd lost a job that day was getting learn to code spammed in their mentions. I was like, this is coming from somewhere. So I took a look at 4chan, their politics board poll, and immediately saw, like, right away, this thread about the layoffs and people saying, let's spam these fuckers with learn to code, you know, like, let's make them commit suicide. That's the goal. Like, I mean, it wasn't subtle. It was right. Very baldly stated. And so I took some screenshots of that thread and obviously then kind of had like, you know, and tweeted them out. And yeah, that's kind of the what happened.
Right, right. And then
I'm so eloquent right now.
No, it's all good. I think, you know, really what comes down to is that there was some sort of, you know, journalists were going on Twitter and basically, you know, as the media industry happens in the media industry, because Twitter is really one of the main social networks, if not the main social networking outlet for people who work in media. I mean,
oh yeah, like it's not even a question. It is the number one. There's not, yeah, it's not close.
Right. From the news industry to even, you know, celebrities who are in movies and TV shows. This is the social network.
Politicians.
Where, right, right. Know. The news, right, exactly. And so in media, you had people who just lost their job basically going to announce to all their followers who already really do follow their every day. You know, they post their stories. They when they're not writing a full story, they basically post, you know, maybe a Twitter thread about, you know, something more minor that they're following. And, you know, people follow their lives on this platform.
And, so, and it's also, it's like, it's hard to overstate how important a professional nexus Twitter is for journalists. I mean, when you put out that announcement, you're saying, hire me to, you know, do what I do. I'm available. I'm on the job market. And, you know, you really get responses to that. Editors are on there too.
Right.
And they, you know, if they see someone that whose work they like, you know, they'll reach out. So to do this is not only like, it's not just like idly writing a Facebook post. There's also some, you know, there are a lot of professional, you know, gains to be made for kind of saying, oh, I was in this round of layoffs.
Right. I mean, in that moment, you know, Twitter becomes LinkedIn for journalists.
Yeah, just like a very chaotic one.
Right.
Where people show up and are like, fuck you. Right. Die. Hey, bitch. Yeah, it's like a crop. It's like LinkedIn was in like the public square. And so, yeah, it's very, so it was totally natural that that was happening. What struck me sort of from the first was that, okay, this is a coordinated thing. You know, this is migrating from place to place. And later I looked and saw that, you know, the layoffs had gotten extensive coverage on Reddit, R the Donald in particular. People have posted about them on Gab as well. And these are all kind of hubs of the right-wing internet. And this refrain of, like, learn to code kind of kept cropping up everywhere. And then coupled with that was a narrative. And the narrative was, journalists told coal miners to just learn to code when they lost their jobs. So we're just saying the same thing. And that kind of was the, so you had two things. It's like cover narrative, which doesn't really hang together if you look at it very closely. And then you had this sort of seemingly innocuous phrase that was being used. Of course, it was being used even in its most benign form. You know, it's spamming, it's irritating, it's, you know, invasive. but it was often coupled with, like, just totally abusive language, mockery, threats. Like, in my case, I got a lot of anti-Semitic imagery. And
oh, there's an anti-Semitic meme specifically made for this, like an actual physical, like not physical, but actual visual, I should say, meme that James Woods shared. That's extremely anti-Semitic, and I'll bring that up later. But absolutely,
oh yeah, the 37-year-old laid-off journalist, and she just happens to have a hook nose.
Yes.
I mean, there's a, I don't, you know, if you've spent any time being a Jew who's loud online, you might have gotten an image that's called the Happy Merchant, and it's of a sort of hunched Jew with a giant hook nose rubbing his hands together. It's sort of ubiquitous. And this is, like, very clearly a variant on that with the same art style and sort of hunch.
Right.
And so, you know, you can tell it shares the same DNA. And this was, like, a pretty clear, you know, I would argue that this is a harassment campaign, but it was also kind of another salvo in an ongoing misinformation war from the right. The tactic that was used is called brigading. And it's when you coordinate, like, kind of a massive swarm. And that can be doing, you know, a variety of things, whether it's everyone search, you know, Talia Levin is a pedophile. And so that becomes like an autocomplete answer because you have hundreds of people who've run that search. That's called SEO bombing. You can, you know, flood someone's YouTube comments or Instagram or post all their social media or dox them or, you know, and then, you know, call their house dozens of times. There are lots of different, like, uses of the tactic, but at its core, it just means kind of a digital migration from one site to another or one Discord chat to Twitter. And brigading was, as you mentioned earlier, kind of critical to Gamergate. It was right. Like a central tactic there. So my kind of point in the New Republic article and something that, you know, I've talked to some people who were very affected by Gamergate, and they said, you know, really it's got the same sort of DNA. It's about hostility to journalists. It's got this misleading cover narrative. And it pretends to be something it's not. Like, this is, you know, and so, like, why are journalists getting so bent out of shape over being told to learn to code? And, you know, when right-wing celebrities like Donald Trump Jr. and Ben Shapiro and, you know, started tweeting about it and saying, like, why are journalists so sensitive?
There is without a doubt, like you mentioned, and I'm glad you mentioned it in your article, because that's really where, you know, I think that's really where we could get really dive into this, is just how much this overlaps with Gamergate. I mean, you know, so much of our online discourse, which really is just discourse in general now, because the internet is such a major part of our everyday lives, you know, has been shaped, at least politically and culturally, by this really fucking stupid harassment-based movement that sprung out of the worst parts of the internet back in, what, like 2013?
2014.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, it sprung out of a man lying about his ex. It was absolutely a wave of harassment fixated on women and people of color. who, even in this situation, in Learn to Code, like another evolution of the Calamity Ganon that is Gamergate, kind of like, I think women and people of color came in for disproportionate harassment as well.
Oh, for what? Listen, back in the Gamergate days, when I was like deep in the trenches there and covering it, and they attempted to dox me, and I can tell you that whatever attempts were made on me is nowhere compared to what all the women who were involved and all the people of color who were involved were getting. Like, they didn't
and women of color, of course, get it double, but it's like, when the right wing that comes up against a man, it's almost like they see a worthy opponent. But with a woman, they just see someone they want to destroy.
Oh, that's really the perfect way to put it, honestly, because that's what you see when it comes down to it.
I mean, so I just had people sending me like really vile stuff, and of course, other people had it even worse and lost more. I just kind of decided to speak out about it. Also, in some way, to draw fire, like, I'm like, I'll talk about it, just because, like, maybe they'll leave other people alone, I don't know, but also just to expose it for what it was, like, in particular, because this narrative, and you had people like Eric Erickson at redstate.com, and, you know, picking up the narrative as if it were authentic or reasonable. There was this sort of photo collage going around of different articles, like, can a coal miner learn to code? And, you know, a bipartisan effort to get coal miners to learn to code. And to my knowledge, like, of the articles I tracked from that collage, like, none were sort of sneering op-eds even. Not that one sneering op-ed
could
represent all of journalism. But, yeah, it was just like, this was coverage of existing programs,
right?
That were out there.
Exactly. And, you know, even Tucker Carlson over on Fox News picked it up and spread it off the internet to his, what, 3 million or somewhat some odd viewers on over on Fox. And, you know, they're not understanding what's going on, so they're taking everything he says as the truth. And
I think you might play the clip, and the way he says, learn to code.
Right.
It's like such a bro. Like, oh, it's... Anyway, he called me up by name.
He did call you up by name.
Maybe it's sort of a badge of honor, because he's such a white supremacist garbage heap.
Oh, I would be... Listen, if he said my name, and if I were you and he said my name, I would be like jumping for joy, clicking my heels together. I'd be so happy. Let's play that clip. I'm not sure if you'll be able to hear it on your end, but... I'll let you know when I pause it to say something, and I'll let you know where I am in the clip, and you won't miss out on anything. I'm sure you've already seen it, actually.
Yeah,
pulling up that clip right now.
Well, the past couple weeks have been pretty awful for American journalists. Hundreds of reporters and editors at places like Huffington Post and BuzzFeed lost their jobs, victims of systemic changes to their industry. No matter what you think of those sites, it's sad. Anyone who's lost his job knows it's very tough. Now, those journalists suddenly have a lot in common with millions of other Americans, factory workers, loggers, retail clerks, coal miners. All of them and many more have seen their way of life disappear thanks to technology or outsourcing or private equity. This kind of thing has been going on a long time. Now, in previous cycles, what we used to call creative destruction, journalists had ready advice for newly unemployed blue-collar workers. Just learn to code. Coding is...
Now, let's just get this straight here. I don't think, and you brought it up before by mentioning those pieces, but he just said how journalists had advice for these coal miners who've lost their job.
And again, that's a false narrative. That's not
right.
Real.
There's no journalists who gave any advice to coal miners. That's not their job to do.
Like, we reported on, you know, journalists reported on programs that existed for job training for coal miners.
Exactly.
And, you know, then it was endorsed by, like, Hillary Clinton and, like, Joe Biden and Obama and, like, you know, like, there's this idea that, like, we'll just, like, take it out on all liberals and that all journalists are liberals and that it's totally fair to, attack us because you didn't like something Obama said or like Michael Bloomberg, like, which is so absurd. And yet, like, the narrative was so deeply rooted and people like Tucker are responsible for spreading it.
Right. Let's go back to this and see what else Tucker has to say about this.
Is the future. Stop whining and embrace it. Here's a selection of headlines you might remember on that subject. This one's from NPR. From coal to code, a new path for laid off miners in Kentucky.
From coal to code, a new path for laid off miners in Kentucky. That's a story about laid off miners in Kentucky literally finding this new path and going about doing this, going about learning to code. It wasn't journalists telling them to learn to code. It was journalists covering a thing coal miners in Kentucky were actually doing.
I know. Yeah, no. And actually, several of these stories, including this one, which is from NPR in May 2016, we're covering a program started by a guy whose real name is Rusty, whose like actual name is Rusty Justice, and he started a program called BitSource. Now, like that's a tech startup in Lexington, and so they do job training. They also have done some job training of like laid off coal miners in the area. Now, maybe it's possible the program received, you know, a little disproportionate coverage, or it was popular to think about, but like it wasn't like journalists made it up or pushed it as an agenda. It was just like something to write about.
Right. And also it's not like they found when a coal miner lost their job and went on Facebook or Twitter or whatever and said, oh, I just lost my job. It wasn't like thousands of journalists were taking to those people's profile pages and spamming comments on them, telling them to learn to code.
You piece of shit, you know?
Right, yeah.
So yeah, there's that. And like, it's just this pernicious narrative of like journalists as a collective did this, you know, gave this advice. It's disturbing to me because it's not accurate, and then it's being cast almost as this like universal truth. Right. And it's something that repeated over and over and over again gets its own life.
Right. Let's go back to the Tucker Carlson clip because I believe you get that name drop in there.
Miners in Kentucky. From Wired, the tech evangelist magazine. Can you teach a coal miner to code? From CBS News, out-of-work coal miners find new work in computer industry.
I'm sorry, I just got to pause it again to bring up this headline. Out-of-work coal miners find new work in computer industry. Literally, the headline is telling you what's going on. It's just unbelievable.
It's descriptive, not right. Prescriptive.
Exactly. It's just ridiculous.
And this from Bloomberg, Appalachian miners are learning to code.
Again, another one. I keep pausing because this is so ridiculous. From Bloomberg, Appalachian miners are learning to code. Again, that headline is not, hey, Appalachian miners learn to code. It's Appalachian miners are learning to code. Just really.
And from the venerable New York Times, oh, the yeah. Coders
oh my God.
Of Kentucky.
I just... click
see,
on YouTube.
It's that
live.
Simple.
That's crazy.
Let's say you spent 30
years. So I think this is where he name drops you. Let's get to this, and then we'll be done with Tucker.
Making a solid middle-class living in a paper mill in northern New Hampshire. Then one day, the mill shuts down, sold for scrap to China. Happened a lot, but no problem. Just learned to code. Everyone in Brooklyn's doing it. Well, coding was never a real solution to any of this, obviously, but it had the effect of making journalists feel even more self-satisfied. And, of course, that was the point. It's always the point, actually. Fast forward to this month. Someone on Twitter came up with a pretty brilliant piece of advice for all those laid-off journalists trying to figure out what to do with their lives. Learn to code.
Well, that's wrong, too, by the way. He says somebody on Twitter came up with a brilliant piece of advice for these journalists who lost their job. You've clearly laid out and have visual evidence that you've posted online that shows that this did not start with some right-wing schmuck on Twitter who decided to offer some advice. It was started on 4chan, and it was started as a harassment campaign.
Yeah, no. I mean, to be clear, like, I saw evidence on 4chan that it had at least been planned or coordinated partly there. Like, if, I don't know, maybe there's some forum I missed, but like, I know that it was discussed there, you know, early, just as it was beginning, and before, you know?
Right. I mean, that's at least where the coordination of the whole, hey, this is really about ethics in journalism started.
Yeah. And exactly. And it's about ethics in journalism. Like, I think people also miss about Gamergate that it had this profound hostility towards the media and attacks on media outlets and, you know, attacks on advertisers for those media outlets who wrote about Gamergate, especially critically. So you definitely had Gawker as a major target for that. And so, again, like going back to just these tactics and how they've kicked around and evolved. And,
right. It was called, they called it like Operation, like Disrespectful Nod, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it literally had an operation name, in case you were like wondering if this is really just organic or not.
Right, and their whole thing was, okay, this video game journalist is talking about more women in gaming, and so we'll harass all of the outlet that hires her, all of their advertisers will harass them and tell them that this writer is a misogynist or whatever. Or for in Gawker's case, Sam Biddle made that joke. Their writer Sam Biddle made that joke about how more of these Gamergate nerds should be bullied. And so they harassed all of Gawker's advertisers with a campaign saying how Gawker supports the bullying of children and shit like that. And that's basically what they did. They would take something and pervert it into something that it wasn't and convince people who weren't familiar with these sort of tactics that, oh, wow, I'm getting all these emails. This must be really what's going on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So let's go back to Tucker here. He's going to say your name now.
This is like the longest replay. It's like not that long.
Yeah, I keep pausing it. I keep pausing it.
No,
that's why.
I enjoy it. It's great. I'm like MST3K-ing a clip I'm not watching. It's great.
Perfect. Suddenly, Learn to Code was everywhere on Twitter. But journalists didn't see the humor in this at all. A former New Yorker employee called Talia Lavin called the phrase, quote, far-right hate. People who went to Wesleyan shouldn't have to learn to code. So they complained to the censorship authorities at Twitter, who immediately concluded that asking someone to learn to code might be, quote, targeted harassment, but only when it's directed at people who used to work at BuzzFeed. For the paper mill guy in New Hampshire, coding is still the future.
You know what? I would just like to state that he said a writer in Brooklyn called Talia, and he said your name wrong, but called Talia. I mean, yeah, people call you Talia because it's your name. Who says that?
It's very sinister of me to have a name.
Yeah.
No, but it's Levin, rhymes with engraven. It's not Levin or Levine.
I think I said it right.
You did.
There we go. I'll take the credit for that one.
Yeah. I mean, listen, rhymes with engraven. It's very catchy, I think.
Right. No, I think it's, I don't know how, once you know engraven, I don't know how you could say anything but Levin.
Exactly. Anyway, but I'm not self-obsessed. It's fine. I have to say it was very wild to me and very funny. Like this idea that I'd like been like, oh, 4chan did this, and then like wind up on Tucker Carlson a couple days later. Like to me, that's such a good illustration of the sort of content pipe of the right. And a lot of people have noticed this and written about it, like Ben Collins over at NBC, and just the way there's this information sphere that kind of digests right-wing news and spits it out again. It's an ecosystem.
Right. No, absolutely. And they, you know, by getting this on Fox News, they're basically spreading this to their internet savvy.
The people that aren't terminally online. But so,
right,
you know, you watch in the span of days a 4chan harassment campaign specifically designed to torment laid off journalists into committing suicide. and it's on Fox News. just like days later. And this is something that's been illustrated time and time again, the way Tucker specifically and his producers kind of draw stuff from the darkest parts of the internet. And, you know, a notable example was when Tucker Carlson had a segment about like white farmers in South Africa.
Right.
And that had sort of filtered up from really far right activists, racist activists, whatever you want to call it. Like Lauren Southern had done a documentary about it. And then it migrated into the Chans. And then it, you know, migrated onto Tucker Carlson. And so, you know, this idea of like the white man's plight, even though it bears, you'll be shocked to hear this, like the narrative that they're disseminating, that, you know, white people are under severe daily threat of having their land stolen in South Africa and you know, just like about to be slaughtered en masse, is not like hugely factually accurate. And there are a lot of people, notably Michael Beckert over at Africa is a Country, have done some really good work kind of elaborating on, you know, how this narrative was born and where it diverges from right. point of fact. Yeah.
Right. So, and listeners of this show will know that I've had Christina Lopez from Media Matters on the show to talk about exactly that, the whole white people being genocided in South Africa bullshit meme they started.
Yeah, exactly. So I worked with Christina on reporting on that because I was a Media Matters researcher
for
a few months. Also, in their right extremism now, department.
I want to give you credit right now for the talking with me while, what is it, cooking or something? This is fantastic.
I'm making chicken soup. Can you hear the noises? I'm sorry.
Absolutely, but it's great because you're able to do all these things. I could never do that. I would be terrible at it. But
well, it keeps my mind off my nerves. I'm making Avgo Limono soup. If I were hip, I would live stream this like AOC. but it's just going to be delicious soup. It's a Greek recipe. It's got eggs and lemons in it. It's very nice on a winter night.
Oh, I've had that soup before. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's wonderful. One of my favorite things to make, actually. Just because it's very soothing.
Right, right. And now,
anyway, sorry.
No, it's okay. And this is a conversational, chill show. There's no need to be sorry. This is all about just hanging out. So
no, I like it.
So one thing that, you know, also I was thinking about when reading this stuff is that, you know, writers and coal miners, for example, if they're going to make that comparison, the jobs are very different in terms of a coal miner loses his job and the industry of coal mining is changing. And really, you know, because what's going on in the energy industry, coal mining will probably cease to exist eventually. And coal miners can't go off and, for example, become freelance coal miners, for example, you know, and go down to their basement or go to their, you know, their room or whatever and coal mine freelance or something like that. So, coal miners, unfortunately, if they lose their job because of the changes going on in that industry, unfortunately, they have to probably find a new job. And listen, I think the government should step in and pay them to do training and get, you know, green energy jobs. Or if they want to learn to code, if they choose to do so, I think there should be government-funded programs that help these people move into these new careers.
I don't want to speculate on that, really. I mean, I think coal is a pollutant, but I don't want anyone to lose their job. But, like, I'll go a step further and suggest universal basic income would be super helpful.
Right.
I think journalism as an industry is certainly going through tremendous turmoil. Certainly there are those who would like to see an independent press completely cease to function. But I hope that that's not on the verge of happening.
Right, but there's always
journalism as a profession will survive. It's just that right now, the professionals working in the field are going under a tremendous amount of upheaval. And I will say that another hazard of working in the media industry is precisely this kind of shit. Like, you make yourself hyper-visible because that's a way to get work. And to be known for your commentary and to be known for your stories. You know, social media, building up a social media network can be tremendously beneficial in terms of getting your stories read, you know, getting a highly trafficked story, doing the numbers in that sense. And so, and building up a social media persona can be helpful in terms of making editors want to have you write for them. And like, it's as simple as that. And so, the sort of hyper visibility that comes from the job then also makes journalists more vulnerable to this kind of harassment. And I can't tell you the number of journalists, especially female journalists I know, who've been doxxed, who've been really violently and viciously spoken to. We get hate mail constantly. You know, of course I have my own examples, but it is industry-wide and it is pervasive. And while anyone, especially, you know, who certainly covers the far right, but also in the entire profession, like, faces the risk of this kind of backlash and this kind of harassment. And I think it disproportionately falls on the shoulders of women, people of color. Women of color in particular are kind of dually targeted in this way. And so that's something it's difficult to talk about because people always want to tell you, like, you're whining, you're like, just get off Twitter, or just like, it's not that big a deal. You're too sensitive, the kind of Tucker Carlson stuff. But I think it is worth at least noting that, like, to do your job as a media professional in the 21st century, enduring racist and or sexist harassment and or anti-Semitic harassment is just par for the course. It's absolutely considered normal. And I think that speaks to, for one thing, you know, Twitter's total laxity when it comes to addressing its massive harassment problem. And I will say that in this case, after several articles had been written about the phenomenon, Ben Collins over at NBC wrote about it. It's gotten covered at Think Progress and lots of other outlets. Like, following that, reporting Learn to Code tweets that came in to me, I would write, like, part of the Learn to Code harassment campaign. And, you know, the response was so much quicker than even when on the very same day I would report something like, go to hell, you stupid bitch, or whatever, like, just things that were obviously harassment, but then just didn't get suspended. So, you know, and of course, that's like part of the thick soup of the Learn to Code narrative is like, oh, journalists complain to the harassment authorities at Twitter is what Tucker said. And, oh, you can get suspended on Twitter just for telling a journalist to learn to code. It's like, well, you can be suspended on Twitter for taking part in like a documented harassment campaign,
right,
targeting specific people, like for having the temerity to lose a job. You fucking assholes.
Right. I mean, like, they're trying to, like, pretend again that there's something like, again, just like they're trying to pretend this is just a response to what journalists did to coal miners, which is untrue. They're now pretending that Twitter is just banning people who have the audacity to simply say learn to code. Again, not true.
Yeah, it's a it's really, again, remarkable how it then gets twisted into this narrative of, like, somehow the right is being, like, victimized. Somehow they're standing up to like, the bad guys and, you know, getting stomped on for it. And this notion of sort of specious victimization is really a common refrain in right-wing rhetoric, but it's also, like, sort of conditions that they created and then talk about.
Right.
So, it's just, like, it's very frustrating watching it all happen in real time. And, like, what I hope to do by writing about it was not to, like, draw sympathy for my terrible plight, but rather just, like, illustrate as it happened something that I think has a profound effect, a cycle and a tendency and an information pattern
right. That
has real consequences for the way we consume news, the narratives that surround, you know, current events. So I think that's why I chose to write about it and speak about it, knowing that as it did, it sort of invited redoubled harassment.
Right, right. Well, it's important that you do, that, you know, any journalist does that, but especially, you know, when you experience it yourself and have that sort of, you know, real understanding of what's going on, because you clearly discovered where this was coming from. I mean, I think it's extra important because you have that, you know, you have that experience that other people are having and you're able to convey that. But did you see, actually, that this piece that came out today in Media Matters that said that how there's now a conspiracy theory around the whole journalism layoff thing?
Yeah, well, there was from the start. Like, I saw the, I mean, I actually didn't read the piece you're referring to, so you can tell me what the new conspiracy theory is.
Right.
But actually, these layoffs started during the government shutdown, which already feels like 10 years ago, but whatever. Or maybe shortly thereafter. And the chans were full of, like, is it any coincidence that the government shut down and, like, suddenly all these journalists are being laid off? Like BuzzFeed was being paid by the government. Like, it's so fucking crazy.
This one is sort of like that, but apparently a QAnon believer, some QAnon believer over on Gab, surprising, is spreading that there was a Countering Disinformation and Propaganda Act that was included in the NDAA that Obama apparently signed that lasted for 2 years, giving $160 million under the act to whoever they think was given $160 million. And that expired now. And that's why all these journalists are being laid off, because if you think about it, that $160 million divided by 1,000 journalists, they saw the 1,000 metric too. And they say it comes out to $80,000 a year plus benefits. Clearly, that money ran out, and that's why all these journalists are losing their job now. Thanks, Obama.
Damn it. Where was that sweet Obama money when I worked at HuffPost in 2015?
Right.
I got paid $10 an hour.
Right. Well, he signed that deal after you were done working there. That's why. He signed that act. Yeah.
I see.
That's what happened.
Damn. missed out. I mean, the other thing is, like, you're also dealing with sort of a crowd that, like, might not process reality in the same way. QAnon is very special. I don't know. I'm just, like, I've gone, like, a couple rounds with the right before online. And it's interesting to see that, like, the same tactics repeated, the same lines used. I mean, it's just, like, and always with the, like, rank misogyny and the overt anti-Semitism. Like, it's so, you know, I don't know. It's weird. I'm working on a book proposal about the far right online right now. So I've been trying to come up with coherent narratives about it. And mostly I'm just like, it's so fucked up. Like, how the fuck do I explain what, like, Gab is and how things migrate from the Daily Stormer to, you know, to, like, to the Daily Stormer, to people who have never heard of what these are or why they would be important. It's like talking about these ecosystems and the way they work and their the sort of consequences can make you sound extremely online and like a little bit gimlet-eyed, maybe. Right. But like the truth is that, especially for media professionals, like to be sort of ODing on news all the time is sort of the new normal.
Right. Well, you know, I think you will, what I really think will go on is that this will just continue, obviously. This is not going anywhere. And I don't know whether the learn to code thing fizzles out or not. That's besides the point. This whole idea of right wingers online galvanizing basically together to form these sorts of harassment campaigns to really what it comes down to, their whole driving force. It's not policy. It's not, you know, things that will help people. It's all about really owning the libs. So this will be something to undoubtedly watch for, I don't know, for how long, probably forever. And I'm glad
for as long as there's an online to be.
Right.
I think owning the libs and the efflorescence of revenge-based politics in the last few years is definitely, the last 4 years or five is something that really is one of the driving engines of American discourse right now. And to me, you know, mapping how it plays out online, as the good folks at Media Matters too, on a daily basis, and just like what these patterns are, is actually pretty important to recognizing that the next harassment campaign is a harassment campaign. Noticing who's targeted, noticing how it plays out. And I think that stuff is really important. You know, unfortunately, to be a literate information consumer today, it helps to just like have an awareness of how these systems work.
Right. Absolutely. I completely agree with that. And I think you laid it out there, basically, why this is important to cover now, because it's going to be something that happens well into the future.
Oh, like, just prepare for the... Gird your loins for the 2020 election, my friends.
Right.
Like, it's starting now. It has started. And it's an important thing to, like, keep an eye on and try to understand as... that, like, there's basically a constant information war. Not an info war, but an information war going on all the time.
Absolutely. Talia Levin, freelance writer. And where can people find more of your work?
I'm on Twitter, as I might have mentioned, at Chick in Kiev. It's a pun on Chicken Kiev. Because I like chicken and butter.
I'm glad you explained that. To me, that might be the most eye-opening thing that I've taken
you
from.
You gain nothing else from the rest of my conversation. No, my Twitter handle is a dumb pun. And yes, every time I say this, it like blows people's minds. They're like, I had no idea. I'm like, I don't know. I made it the year I was living in Kiev. So that was why I did a like Fulbright in Ukraine anyway. But so you can find me on Twitter. You can find me at patreon.com/TaliaLavin, TaliaLavin. And I don't know, I guess that's it for now, but maybe on bookshelves sometime in the next couple of years.
That'd
I hope.
Great. Yeah. Or and maybe they'll even, you know, next time you're doing a media hit, someone or in that when you're on who knows what channel to talk about the book, they'll refer to you as the writer called Talia.
Yeah, Talia Levin. Anyway.
Talia, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Like you said, this is going to happen, especially as 2020 ramps up. And I hope you'll come on again to talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime.
Enjoy. Okay. Enjoy that soup.
I will. Yeah. Also want to pitch, you know, shout out to Avgo Limono soup. It's very tasty and you should make some.
All right. Tyler.
Anyway. Yeah. Have a good night.
You too. Take care.
Bye.
Bye. Boop, bloop. I love that Skype noise. All right. Before we move on from this topic, actually, there was another video I wanted to play. But because Talia wouldn't be able to hear it, I didn't want to, and she, unlike the Tucker video, she wouldn't be familiar with this one because I just discovered it while surfing YouTube. I want to play this now. So, if you look on YouTube if you want to, you know, see this learn to code stuff, there's a, you know, how this is spreading. There's a number of YouTube channels, right-wing YouTube channels, talking about this learn to code harassment campaign, and they're all being disingenuous and doing the same thing Tucker was by bringing up those articles and pretending that journalists were telling coal miners to learn to code when that wasn't the case at all. They were covering actual instances where coal miners were in real life actually on their own going out and learning to code. Now, earlier when I was talking to Talia, we brought up the anti-Semitic background, really, in a lot of these right-wing harassment campaigns that start on 4chan or 8chan or any of these right-wing troll sites. And, you know, anti-Semitic memes like the Happy Merchant, these sort of things fester there, they're created there, they spread from there. And the right really has no problem with them for the most part. And nothing to me was more eye-opening than James Woods, the Hollywood actor who is a right-wing Trump supporter, spreading a version of this Happy Merchant meme that, you know, earlier, again, Talia, she called it as the 37-year-old journalist meme, whatever you want to call it. Let me pull it up here, actually. Let's pull up this James Woods shared meme here. All right, here it is. I'm going to pull it up on the YouTube screen. All right, there we go. So James Woods tweets out, "Sandwich making classes at the hashtag feminist job forum this coming Tuesday. Cats welcome." And here's this meme that was created by 4chan. You can see, there it is, in all of its glory. Well, I believe it was created on 4chan. It's certainly spreading there and spreading across right-wing Twitter. And it says, the 37-year-old laid off journo, and there's an animation of a version of the Happy Merchant meme. You know, there you have a, basically what you see is, and funny enough, I looked this up, and it's actually an over-the-top caricature of, for some reason, they're using, funny enough, James Woods, a Hollywood actor, is tweeting this out. The meme is based on a photo of an actress, Mayim Bialik. She's a Jewish actress. You know her from probably most recently The Big Bang Theory. She plays Sheldon's girlfriend on the show. And literally, they took a picture of her and they made it into this over-the-top illustrated photo. Why are they using her with these illustrated Jewish features accentuated instead of an actual journalist? I don't know. So the meme reads, 37-year-old laid-off journalist. Can't code, uses Harry Potter books for life metaphors, thinks all frogs are Pepe, has a useless gender studies degree, smells of cat litter, spends the day triggered, cried when Hillary lost, has no children. That's the meme. And when surfing YouTube, I came across this one Right-wing YouTuber. Red Elephant's Vincent James. He's this alt-right Trump supporter who runs this website, Red Elephant's. He has this this right-wing conservative YouTube channel. And he's explaining where this meme comes from. And, of course, he goes through this whole thing with the coal miners, too. This disingenuous, it's actually about ethics and gaming journalism, gaslighting job, really, is what it is. But listen to him talk about this 37-year-old laid-off journal meme. Now, remember, this isn't some right-wing troll. This is supposed to be some sort of mainstream Trump pundit. Listen to what he says. He can't help himself. Because behind this all is... Well, let me really just play this part of the clip so you understand.
All right, so I want to go over this meme that the entire media is freaking out about. All of these verified journos on Twitter are entirely mad about this meme. And
let
that
me fast
is the
forward to the part.
Learn to code.
Let me fast forward to the part where it matters. Here we go.
Journos who don't get the irony of the meme and what they've told laid off coal miners and steel workers to do in the past and how and where this economy is going.
Bullshit. But as you can see, he brings up a article about Mayim Bialik. He too understands where this meme came from, where this this illustration came from.
Because of immigration, because of H-1B visas taking
work. All right, let's fast forward to where he gets to the part.
Involved what this illustration is based off of, if you look at it. And she's worn, like, scarves like this, too. I think that this is who this is based off of, in my personal opinion. Many of you will probably ask, why do all these people happen to be of Ashkenazi descent? Like Rosenberg, Mayim Bialik, and all these different people, Levin, who's attacking the Christian schools. I mean, it probably has to do with the top five companies who own most of the media outlets in the country happen to be also owned and run by the same type of people. I mean, that's what people would say. I'm not saying that, but that's what people would say. I'd leave it up to you guys in the comments to explain that further. But that's the essence of the meme.
There you have it. This guy can't even help himself. He walks right into it, realizes he's saying what he's saying as he's saying it. There you go. The Jewish conspiracy. He couldn't even... This is a mainstream-styled Trump-supporting pundit. This is just... Why are all these journalists why do they all have these last names? Why are they all Ashkenazi Jews? They run all these, some would say it's because they run all these, the media companies. Oh, some would say, not, you know, I'm not saying it. Some would say this, but why don't you tell me in the comment section below? Own your anti-Semitism, buddy. Christ. It's really fantastic. That's the crux of it there, folks. Couldn't even help himself. Walks right into it. All right, everybody. To support this show, go to patreon.com/MattBinder. Patreon had some issues this month across their whole platform with their payment processor, and because of it, we actually lost a few subscribers based on some sort of credit card declining issues. This isn't the usual issue because, you know, every now and then Patreon gives you the information all the time, about how many people get declined when they charge your subscribers. And every now and then, you know, there's one or two declines. That's fine. That's what happens. But this month, because of the issue that they emailed people about, saying they had payment processor issues, there was an enormous amount of declines, and I lost a few subscribers, more than usual. Let's sign up for Patreon if you can afford to do so, everybody. Patreon.com/MattBinder. You get this show. You help fund this free show. and you get the members portion of the program. Also, you can support this show by going to iTunes and leaving a review. A 5-star review is greatly appreciated. You can also leave a written review. Most importantly, you can also subscribe to this YouTube channel that some of you are watching. This is mainly going to you podcast listeners. Go to doomed.tv and subscribe to the YouTube channel. Just click that subscribe button. It's free. That's really all you can do to help me. Follow me on Twitter, at Matt Binder. Folks, that's the actually, before we go into the members half, there's one more thing I want to talk about. Really short. There was this whole conspiracy. Let me rephrase that. There was this whole scandal on Twitter, basically, this past week. Because Bernie Sanders announced he was going to do a response to the State of the Union address on Tuesday, Trump's State of the Union address, which was this past Tuesday. Bernie Sanders announced he was going to do his own response, which he's been doing, I believe, for the past 2 or 3 years. Now, the Democrats had announced that they were going to have Stacey Abrams do the official Democratic response this year. Fantastic. Stacey Abrams, I think, is great. Bernie Sanders thinks Stacey Abrams is great. He endorsed her for Georgia governor back during the election, campaigned for her, and she was very happy to have his endorsement. She promoted it. And so there was this whole scandal online by centrist Democrats and you know, centrist liberals, you know, the anti-Bernie, never Bernie contingent online, who was saying that Bernie Sanders was trying to upstage Stacey Abrams because he was going to do his own State of the Union address. And now, it didn't matter to them that, again, like I said, Bernie Sanders has been doing this for years. It didn't matter to them that Bernie Sanders explicitly, specifically, said that his State of the Union address, his response to Trump, was going to come after Stacey Abrams' official Democratic response. Bernie even tweeted out and promoted Stacey Abrams' Democratic response right after Trump's State of the Union. There was attacks online. You had, you know, the usual liberal pundits going after him, saying, wow, way to misread the room, Bernie. Whoa, way to steal the spotlight from Stacey Abrams, Bernie. Sit down, Bernie. And you had, you know, you had everyone from Chris Cillizza over at CNN and even The Root, who's usually really good, but going ahead and actually quoting Chris Cillizza, which, listen, here's a little word of advice to everybody who writes about anything. If you find yourself block quoting Chris Cillizza, to prove a point, to prove your point is correct, because his piece agrees with you, you should probably sit back before you hit that publish and think, wait a minute, what's going on here? I'm on the same page as Chris Cillizza? You need to rethink what's going on and where your position lies. But all that aside, the reason I'm bringing this up now is because something incredible happened. And by incredible, I mean it should have been seen a mile away coming. So Stacey Abrams does her speech. I thought it was a good speech. It was especially important that she was the first ever black woman to offer up an official major party's State of the Union response. Great to see history made. Directly after, Bernie Sanders goes ahead and does his response. In fact, not even directly after. It was about 10, maybe even 20 minutes after. And then you see that, wait a minute, Bernie isn't the only person offering up his own State of the Union response. You had Kamala Harris, an official 2020 presidential candidate, giving her own State of the Union response. Granted, she gave hers before Trump, I don't see how that somehow takes away from the argument that giving your own upstage is the official response in any way, shape, or form. Yet here you had, actually, when people brought it up online, you had MSNBC pundits and analysts and, you know, centrist Democrat Twitter personalities basically defending Kamala Harris giving her own State of the Union response because it came before and not after. Where is this rule that states you're stealing the spotlight if you do one after she gives her speech, but not if you do one before? What does that even mean? That's ridiculous. That's a joke. First of all, I also want to add an addendum here. In my opinion, if you ask me, everyone should give their own State of the Union response. And I wrote an article for Mashable laying out why they should. Everyone should be live streaming in this age of digital media where every politician can grab their phone, have a staffer hold up a computer or a camera, and they could spread their message. With all these different media outlets fighting for faces and screen time, you should be out there taking up some of those hours that are being uploaded. Good for Kamala Harris, good for Bernie Sanders to do their own State of the Union response. It helps keep the Democrats in the media. It helps them... excuse me. It helps them basically take up YouTube space. Take up Facebook Live time. That aside, though, going back to other State of the Union responses, you had, let me pull up exactly here who else was giving these responses. It was incredible, honestly. Incredible. I could not believe it. You have, and, you know, Brett Banditelli over on Twitter discovered some of these. You had Senator Sherrod Brown, another 2020, rumored 2020 Democratic presidential candidate, who jumped on Facebook Live to give his own response. This was at around 11 p.m. Sorry, 12 a.m., midnight, I should say, after Stacey Abrams' response. You had Chris Murphy, senator from Connecticut, Democratic senator from Connecticut, doing a Facebook Live response, doing basically taking watchers' questions about the State of the Union during Bernie's response. You had Senator Hirono giving her own video response on Facebook. Rep. Norma Torres posting a State of the Union response. These are all Democrats, I want to say. And this, to me, was the most amazing one. Really, just no shame at all. Rep. Eric Swalwell. He had earlier, a day beforehand, quote, tweeted a news tweet from The Hill about Bernie Sanders delivering his own response. And he adds, "I'm with Stacey Abrams. Can't wait to hear her vision of our future." Basically, as if there's a choice here, as if Bernie Sanders is asking you to choose between the two of them, as if there's some competition. He's basically stating he had a problem with Bernie giving his response, and he's standing with Abrams. And then this guy ends up going on Facebook and streaming his own Facebook State of the Union response live stream. The nerve. Just unbelievable. The hypocrites. And I should mention here that there were no day after dragging of these people who offered up their own State of the Union responses. There was nothing. They were all given a pass. It was A-okay for them to do it. Because what this really was about was being anti-Bernie Sanders and not liking what he stands for. And to top it all off, if we want to talk about stealing the spotlight from Stacey Abrams, whose Democratic response was broadcast all over the major networks, and rightfully so. Whereas these responses that I just mentioned, including Bernie's, were all just on each individual senator or congressperson's respective social media channels. What happened directly after the State of the Union response was just incredible here. You have, and let me pull this up here so I could get the actual tweet right. Around 11 o'clock on Twitter, Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, tweets out, "I'm making a big announcement on Sunday. Join me there." And now she's been rumored to be a 2020 presidential candidate now for a while. Clearly, this is what she's teasing. And then she goes on Rachel Maddow's show to talk about the State of the Union address. Again, that should be a problem for people who doesn't want any of these Democratic senators upstaging Stacey Abrams. But no, doesn't matter, because she goes on MSNBC, responds to Trump's State of the Union, and then starts talking to Maddow about a possible 2020 presidential campaign. She used all the media attention that was currently basically on our political, happenings going on with the State of the Union address. She used all that media attention to push a teaser out for her upcoming presidential campaign announcement. If you want to talk about upstaging Stacey Abrams, maybe we should talk about someone using this whole thing to push her own presidential campaign and not Bernie Sanders, or even I'll go so far as, even though this didn't happen, condemn any of the other Democratic senators or congresspeople who responded to the State of the Union campaign. Again, Bernie, Kamala, all these people should have been responding to Trump. Really, just unbelievable. But the only person you'll see the think pieces complaining about it, the think pieces complaining about it are the ones talking about Bernie. Well, gave you guys a little bit extra for the free portion of the show. Again, patreon.com/MattBinder. I can't do this show without your support. iTunes review. Subscribe to the YouTube channel. Folks, see you all next time on Doomed. Someone tell them sunset, see this game light up. Put our kids in the hall, come together, put your best up. I'll bring the mic, if I bring it down, so we got all night to get off to the rhythm. The city's set, the times are wrecked. The dollars at the door, and it feels so perfect.